is correct.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Moments of Truth, the show about my favorite moments from my favorite things. I'm Bill Coffin, and today we'll be discussing one of the most original and genre-subverting entries into the ever-expanding canon of superhero storytelling, The Umbrella Academy. In 2007, Gerard Way, frontman for My Chemical Romance, collaborated with Brazilian cartoonist Gabriel Ba to produce The Umbrella Academy, a seriously unorthodox superhero comic to be published that year by Dark Horse on Free Comic Book Day. When it came out, The Umbrella Academy was the most successful Free Comic Book Day release of all time, and it has since gone on to produce four story arcs: Apocalypse Suite, Dallas, Hotel Oblivion, and the spinoff You Look Like Death. A fifth volume, The Sparrow Academy, is currently underway. Apocalypse Suite won the Eisner Award for Best Miniseries and conclusively put to rest any lingering criticisms that Gerard Way might just be some celebrity tourist dabbling in the world of comics. Meanwhile, the series has been adapted into a highly successful Netflix series, with three seasons completed and a fourth under development. The Umbrella Academy is difficult to summarize neatly, but it goes something like this. After the spontaneous birth of 43 young superhumans around the world, the mysterious inventor and entrepreneur Sir Reginald Hargreaves adopts seven of them to hone their powers and forge them into a superhero team. Space Boy has super strength that is developed radically following a near-death experience during a Martian expedition. The Kraken is a violent vigilante who can breathe underwater and throw knives with uncanny accuracy. The Rumor can bend reality with her lies. Seance can talk with the dead, perform telekinesis, and is probably immortal. Number Five, also known as the Boy, can travel in time and along the way develops extraordinary assassination skills. The Horror can project Lovecraftian tentacles from under his skin, and the White Violin can summon immense destructive energy through her music. Together, as the Umbrella Academy, our strange heroes face a truly bizarre menagerie of foes, including vampire Viet Cong, a sentient goldfish that is also an interdimensional mastermind, the statue of Abraham Lincoln, runaway murder bots, and more. Amid all of this madcap chaos, however, is a deep story of family dysfunction. Inspired by Grant Morrison's run on DC Comics' The Doom Patrol, although Marvel fans will spot parallels to the uncanny X-Men as well, The Umbrella Academy is really about seven people stuck with weird powers they never asked for, a father who does not love them, an inability to keep from hurting each other, and enough collective trauma to fill 70 lives, not just seven. Whether it's on page or on screen, The Umbrella Academy is one of the most ingenious deconstructions of the superhero genre ever made, and it's going to be an awful lot of fun for us to talk about it now, so let's get into it. With me today is the most empathetic cult leader you ever met, Chris Crenshaw.
I've been telling them we have till 2024.
Somebody who has absolutely nothing special about them, Tom Hespos.
Looks like it's frozen waffles again.
And joining us from his lunar outpost, special guest and space boy, John Radasta.
Will you look at that moon?
Everybody, welcome. This is one of our so-called golden ticket episodes of the season, where each of us kind of, you know, chose a topic we really, really wanted to do. This episode was chosen by Tom. This is Tom's golden ticket episode. So, Tom, why don't you kick us off with, give us what your moment of truth from the Umbrella Academy is. Walk us through it a bit, especially for people who haven't read the comic or seen the show. There's a lot going on here. So kind of explain what your moment of truth is, give some background to it, but then give us some insight as to why this is your favorite moment about your favorite thing.
Sure. I mean, well, I think it's tough to do that without just describing how I fell down the rabbit hole, which was probably the weirdest entry into any kind of franchise that I've ever had in my life. I am sitting on a train, a Long Island Railroad train. I used to have this horrific commute, an hour and a half on that train each direction. And I'm playing something on a racing game on my PSP. If you remember those, they were the little portable PlayStation.
Yeah.
Mini.
Yeah, they were cool.
I love that thing. And I'm playing this guy. It was a racing game. Maybe it was Burnout Legends. Maybe it was something else. Like, I can't really remember, but it had terrific music.
Yeah.
And, you know, I started looking up, like, all right, well, what is this the music that's in this video game? And that's what stumbled me into My Chemical Romance. There was, you know, this song called Thank You for the Venom as the soundtrack for this race, in the soundtrack for the racing game. And I'm like, huh, this sounds really interesting. And so I fell down the My Chemical Romance rabbit hole. And, you know, there's something about that band. You know, if you go back to the Desert Island episodes, you know, there's a reason why, you know, the Black Parade was on my list for that episode.
Right.
I mean, this stuff is just so theatrical and over the top and just bonkers music. You know, it's like Queen meets, you know, any of your favorite two guitar bands, like, you know, Guns N' Roses or AC/DC. It's like that kind of a blend with through this lens of just this macabre strangeness that I just absolutely loved at the time and still do. You know, and more I read about My Chemical Romance, I'm like, wait a second, this guy's doing a comic book? Like, what is going on here? And that led me down another rabbit hole of, like, you know, these guys who are not, you know, they're rock stars, but, you know, love to do comic book stuff on the side. So, you know, you got, you know, folks like Coheed and Cambria. Like, that was a whole other rabbit hole that I fell down that I absolutely loved.
Kiss.
You know, and it's like you said, Bill, it's like these guys are not just rock stars vacationing in the world of comics. They're doing some really cool and compelling stuff.
Yeah.
I cut you off, Chris.
So not Kiss.
Not Kiss. We've had a long Kiss.
although I'm sure if somebody told Gerard, you know, Gerard Way that maybe he could put some of his own blood in the ink, he would do it, right?
Yeah, who wouldn't?
Well, he certainly would. I mean, I, you know.
I look at chapter titles in the comic, like, We Only Meet at Weddings and Funerals, like,
yeah.
That might as well be a My Chemical Romance song title.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. Yeah, you know, it's just really but, you know, a lot of the stuff that I liked about the band sort of bled over into this comic. And I love it for that reason. It's just like it is so over the top. The first time, you know, you encounter this team having like a battle, they're fighting the Eiffel Tower. You know, piloted by a robot zombie, you know, Gustav Eiffel or whoever. And you're like, what is going on here? It is just so like crazy over the top. Like, I love that over the topness about it. It instantly made it one of my favorite comics was, you know, reading that like right from the beginning. I'm like, oh, man, this is going to be a fun little trip. It caught my attention right away. But, you know, my moment of truth with this, I think, you know, comes during Apocalypse Suite, you know, the first sort of chapter in all of this, where you get this sort of interesting introduction to just how dysfunctional this family is. You have the white violin, you know, Vanya, who's the number seven of the group, who, you know, is never really officially recognized as a member of the team as they do all their superhero stuff. She's been kept sort of to the side by Hargreaves and saying, you know, like, there's nothing special about you. You can't play with the other children. You can't do any of the other stuff with the, you know, the superhero stuff with the children. It turns out Vanya is actually very much more powerful than anybody ever suspected.
Yeah.
And how you get your first sort of insight into that is she's recruited into this, you know, group of musicians that want to destroy the world. And they're very upfront with her about, like, hey, how would you like to help us destroy the world? And
it's the best. I love this about this universe, Tom. Like people are just like, yeah, I'm a villain. Sue me.
I'm a villain. Yeah, told you up front, told you everything you need to know in the first sentence. And so you know, they try to recruit her into this orchestra of musicians that will play the composition that will destroy the world. You know, you're not exactly sure how that's going to happen, but
it's like the world's deadliest joke.
What
was the name of that? It was the
Redempt Orchestra.
And you know, this conductor of this is, you know, the villain who tries to recruit Vanya, the white violin, into this the Apocalypse Suite. He tells her, and she's like, oh, forget you guys, you know, I'm gonna get out of here, you guys are crazy. And there's a moment where this henchman decides he's gonna go after Vanya, and the conductor just kind of grabs him and holds him back and said, don't go after her, she's gonna go back to her family. And then she'll be back here in very short order because essentially it's gonna.
I know how that's
seriously. Goes. They're not gonna yell. She's gonna. He's really playing to the family dysfunction and trying to just tip off a piece. This is if you had to make the analog to the Avengers, this is Zemo.
Thank you.
Drive a wedge, and he doesn't really need to try very hard to do that because this family is just so. Dysfunctional,
and they have a unique family dynamic.
They do.
Putting it mildly,
it tells you right off the bat, like they can be counted on to be that dysfunctional. It's a nice cue to the reader, and sure enough, she is back, later to help them try to destroy the world. But right off the bat, it's very, like Chris said, it's very upfront, like, hey, I'm a villain, hey, we're gonna destroy the world, hey, it's not gonna take a whole lot of effort to convince you to do that because your family's so screwy.
There's a great detail in that. The story starts by introducing all the characters pretty quickly because they all come together because old man Hargreaves dies, right? Like they've all split apart. They've been split apart for a while and they come back together to kind of, to mourn him collectively. And we learn off stage, during the time they've been, well before the book gets started, Vanya wrote a tell-all book about what it's like to grow up with it, where the brothers and sisters. And it reminded me of how, when we did our episode back about the Watchmen, we talked about, when Hollis Mason writes Under the Hood, right? And I get the sense this is both Wei kind of nodding to that, because Wei he sets up his comic chops pretty openly, as he does all this. We know the book's there, but in The Watchmen, they keep talking about the book, right? Like that book was such a betrayal. Here it's you mentioned the book almost of course she wrote a book because it was so bad she had to write a book. you see it on an end table.
You see it on her nightstand,
And as if she's reading her own book, right?
Yeah.
And then, but then that's it. They don't talk about it anymore. To me, I was like, that's how screwed up they are. Like they don't even need to drive that home. You're like, yeah, no, I get it.
So great. Oh man. So. But yeah, you have this crazy family that can be counted on to just do the opposite thing of what the relationship with siblings requires.
Well, yeah, I think Tom, I don't think that anybody can really talk about this family without talking about mom.
Right.
I mean, mom is such a big deal, and I think we're gonna let her go missing if we don't stop. I think mom is
good point.
A robot. Evidently patterned on a hot girl Owen Hargreaves used to know. and
there was a sequence of all the different moms that they tried. I don't know if it was a season. It now I'm crossed up between the books now and the,
series. It was like Mary Poppins, wasn't it?
Well, they had, I think they had six or seven, and each one died a horrible death.
Right.
Spinal Tap drummers.
They finally decided to build a robot. that might have been, no, I think it was season one. I think it was part of the talk about Vanya and her development. But it was just the ridiculous ways to kill a nanny in that. And that's why we ended up with a robot for a mom.
Hargreaves would be the one to say, oh God, can't do this. Do this the right way.
And he waited for five or six of them to go before he really decided, all right, I guess I better do a robot. I mean, he didn't have a care for any of the nannies. It was just frustrating that he wasn't getting to his goal.
Yeah, exactly.
No. It wasn't out of empathy or running out of nannies.
No. The one thing I love about the dysfunction, it's such the number one, kind of aspect of this whole book, right? There's been so much superhero deconstruction in the last 10 to 15 years, right? And a lot of it has been kind of cynical and mean-spirited, right? Either just trying to dunk on the genre in general or just dunk on the very notion of it and talk about how stupid it all is. And that doesn't really bring a whole lot
break
to me.
Break your heroes and show them to you.
Yeah, that doesn't do a lot for me. But what I thought was really ingenious about Umbrella Academy is that it really touched upon like the dysfunctional family dynamic that is hinted at but never really fully explored in a number of kind of tentpole comic series, right? We're talking, I mentioned Doom Patrol initially, and X-Men, especially like the Claremont years of the Uncanny X-Men for sure. But also things like Batman with the, you know, with the Bat family, the Captain Marvel, you know, Captain Marvel's family,
the Spider family,
the Fantastic Four.
Sure.
The original, right. This reminded me a lot of the Lee Kirby era Fantastic Four.
Yeah, for sure.
Where Ben Grimm and Johnny Storm are always fighting. And,
right.
You know, and, Mr. Fantastic was the worst husband, boyfriend, what husband, whatever.
And the Venture terrible. Brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. You know, and this is kind of an interesting aspect of modern comic publishing is that you don't have to necessarily commit to something that you feel like, oh, we're doing a comic, therefore it's going to publish in perpetuity. We have to set up certain settings and characters and then basically not, you know, agree to not change them more than a certain amount, right? With Way, that's out the window from right. panel one, right? So anything can happen at any time. So he can really dive into these characters and really just break the crap out of them, right? And mine that narrative territory in ways you really couldn't with, say, you know, Reed Richards and Sue Storm, right?
Right.
Or with Professor X and Jean Grey, right. or those kinds of things. And so it was really delightful to see that finally get expressed and looked at, because it was always there, but you just knew it couldn't be talked about. Chris, go ahead.
No, I'm gonna save it. Like we're impinging on what I want to say.
Outstanding. All right, then I will back off for sure. For sure. So
I don't want to, you know, take too much away from what Chris will say, but like, you know, the reason why you read this book is the depth of the characters. The fights and stuff like that seem to me to be more like secondary. I'm more interested in hearing about, you know, how they interact with one another, and like the depth of some of these traumas is just like so out there. You're like, oh my God. You know, when it's revealed what Hargreaves has done to each of these kids, it is just horrific. And what happens when you lock the kid who can talk to the dead in a crypt, you know, overnight and just leave him there to be terrorized, you know, by the spirits of you know, whoever is
who all want something from him that he can't provide.
Yeah, exactly. This is clearly a universe without child protective services, right? Let's just get that out of the way right now. So
no, this is this universe. You're this rich.
Fair enough. I know you introduced John to Umbrella Academy. You introduced me to Umbrella Academy. Chris, I don't know if he introduced you to it or not, but
no,
I certainly owe you a debt of gratitude for, because I wouldn't have come across this, I don't think otherwise.
I came across it through the show.
Well, that's a great segue, because I think we're going to move over to John's moment of truth, which I believe is about the show, right? So
I had a ton of traveling to do, and I was looking on a streaming service for something that I could download to my device that didn't need you know, Wi-Fi or any other kind of connection. And, you know, those are usually kind of the least popular, you know, or lower end stuff. It certainly wasn't the premium, you know, programming, right? And the Umbrella Academy was in that batch. So all of season one, I think, was already out. So I was late to the party, and I just loaded it onto my device, and I was flying back and forth from Pennsylvania to Arizona, somewhere around 6 hours worth of travel between connections and flights and those kind of things. Watched the series nonstop. And when we got back and we were hanging out and Tom said, you know, there's this book. I was blown away by the comparisons between the book. I was blown away by the differences between the book and what they did with the series. But my moment of truth was, I didn't know anything about what I had downloaded. I was kind of, you know, I had like 10 other things that I could choose from. I had some comic books to read. I had other things, you know, the device had everything I needed, right? And I was captured initially by the dysfunctionality. I was like, man, what's this story that's going on here? In the midst of it, I think it's right after Luther finds out that he's been on the moon for, you know, the better part of his life. His head has been grafted on the head, on the body of a Martian gorilla. Like, all this horrible stuff has happened to him. He comes back to Earth to save the planet, and he finds out that none of his missives, none of the things that he was doing from the moon to Earth, all the information that he had shared and sent to Hargreaves, to his father, was never read. And I think it was in that moment that he was in his room getting ultra depressed. And he puts on, I Think We're Alone Now. Mm-hmm. And it turned the show into something completely different for me. It really opened up my heart. Like, I felt like this show went from being something that was, very much about, destruction, and sort of painted a completely different picture about what was going on. These were siblings who grew up together. These were siblings who loved each other. In spite of all this crazy stuff that their alien father did to them, and it kept them from enjoying it, and all that kind of stuff. And, to see them dancing to the lyrics, hearing the lyrics, and really making that connection, it was just one of those amazing connections for me between the characters and the story, and what a brilliant contrast to the what a way to pull to tell everybody that these are really kids who have grown up together.
I love that sequence is just great. So perfect, like the second he drops the needle on the record, and like
and
you see everybody doing their own little bop to it, you know, like they each have their own like little stereotypical dance that they do, kind of like the Madonna, kind of thing going on. It's great to see all their little styles. Klaus, of course, is doing this extravagant,
Bob Fosse kind of.
if I might stretch my topic to other musical numbers,
by all means,
in series three, the Footloose between the Sparrow Academy and
I haven't seen season three. No, go ahead. Sorry, it's okay.
You're not gonna spoil anything.
That's okay.
No, it's all good.
That is a shining moment in season three. That's all I can tell you.
Well, in season two, Twisting the Night Away is as well, although it's limited to Allison, Klaus, and Vanya.
And the other fantastic, I won't call it a musical number, but the fight to the death between Cha-Cha and Hazel. With poor Agnes tied to the chair while they were kicking each other's ass in that in that tiny little
awful
room.
Motel.
It was just such a juxtaposition of music and action, and I think that stuff's been done a number of times since then and before, but I feel like in the context of the story, the choice was just really something to love and appreciate.
Really reminded me of Legion on FX.
Yes. Yep. Mm. I feel like they're sort of similar stories.
In a way.
Now, during that sequence, though, and I might be remembering it wrong, I got the feeling that they were all dancing on their own in their own rooms, but to the same song at the same time. So they weren't necessarily dancing with each other. They're all just kind of in their own. They're together, but alone. Right. To me, it was like a real bittersweet aspect. Like they're all.
Yeah. No,
like,
I think we're alone now. Right?
Like they're so so close, but so far apart. And they could just they're right there. They could just do it.
In my head canon, they were listening to all that music together growing up. That was them remembering themselves, remembering their childhood, and being together. Yeah. So that may be me putting something more in there than was intended, but that's what I felt.
On this show, we honor headcanon. So.
I am with you on this. that is, honor worthy headcanon. Yeah. However, the show, explicitly says that they were adopted in 1981. The timing of that is a little odd. Like that's the song they were listening to when they were five.
Yeah, well, maybe it was something that mom played for them.
Yeah, maybe. If they're dependent upon Hargreaves to get access to popular music, then all. Yeah. Right. I mean, all bets are off. I mean, they're lucky they got
mom
that.
Mom was going to Sam Goody a lot. Yeah, exactly.
I think mom was trying like hell to keep them together. She was the one who gave them names.
And to avoid Michael Jackson.
That's a nice little detail there, John. That mom was the one who gave them names, because otherwise it would just be called, numbers.
It would have been just the numbers.
Yeah, exactly. No. That album was probably like pulled from like a pile of garbage, like outside like a college dorm room. Like, I'm just gonna get rid of this stuff. I'm like, oh, we'll just free music, whatever it is, John, the question I have for you is that, you came to this through the show first, and then saw the read the graphic novels. I'm just kind of curious, what would you say is something that the show did better for you than the comic? And what is something that you feel the comic did better for you than the show?
Sure. That's a great question. So first of all, that again, thanks to Tom. Tom had actually mailed me the his copy of Apocalypse Suite.
There it is. And here's John's note that I saved. So like, yeah, the listeners can't see this, but I'm holding the Apocalypse Suite with John's note back to me. Like, I dropped it in the mail to him and just said, send it back to me when you're done. And he wrote me this nice little thank you note for doing that. I kept with the book. This is kind of like a thing with our friend group that I absolutely love, is, you know, mailing stuff back and forth to one another.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love getting stuff in the mail, and I know you guys do too.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you know, we when John was like, "Oh yeah, like there's a comic book," I'm like, "Oh, yeah. I got a care package coming for you, buddy."
Yeah. Yeah. So, so quick interruption to everybody out there. Okay, send your friends stuff through the mail. Okay, it's a magical experience.
Everybody loves mail.
Okay, absolutely. So, but anyway, back to the question. So, John, something the show did better than the comic. Something the comic did better than the show. You think?
I felt Klaus, especially in the show, had an incredible amount of depth, and he was way more of a complex character than I think he was in the book. I don't think that was just a limitation of the comic books. I think that's a combination of, you know, writer, director, collaboration, actor. Performer.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I just think that you know, what that character became in the TV series was next level. He was.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
He's a lot more fun too in the show. You know,
he's like, awesome. He's my favorite. He's my spirit animal.
Like, he's this like, sort of like Euro trash kind of great character in the comics, but like, he's this like hippie drug addict.
That's
like,
how I would dress all the time if I could.
In the show. And I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
So, and going the other way, I think that by character, I would say Space Boy or Luther, I enjoyed him even more in the book than I did as the and nothing to the performance, nothing to the writing. So, you know, and maybe it had to do with kind of the zany way he was drawn.
Yeah,
his tiny little head attached to this giant gorilla body.
Yeah. I thought they did a good job, but they couldn't really do it, you know.
Looking back, I think it was the only choice, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
There was that scene where he was in the club, he was clubbing with his shirt off, and he was free. And
was you're like, what the hell?
They were trying to his family was trying to track him down, and their clue was, did you see the hair on that guy?
He's this way, yeah.
The handling of the TV series and that character was great.
Yeah.
But he is a character for me that lives better in the comic book than he did on TV. His complexity is, you know, certainly explored more in the TV series as a, you know, what does it mean to be a leader? Oh, I'm not a leader anymore, and all that kind of stuff. And
you know what I love about Luther is that he's clearly the Cyclops analog.
Oh my God! Yeah,
and he's got a little bit of cop in him, but he's letting it go. He's letting it go.
Exactly. He kind of does. Now, John, I mean, I've known you for a very, very long period of time, so I'm just so thrilled to have you on the show. You are quite the artist, and you've done an enormous amount of comic book, you know, artistry yourself and that sort of thing. So I'd love to know, or let me get your thoughts on the visual presentation of the graphic novels in particular, because Gabriel Ba, this is the first time I ever came across his work. He appears to be more than a little influenced by Mike Mignola in Hellboy, yet does not seem to be ripping him off. Like, he's doing something original with it. I would love to get your thoughts on the visual identity of the graphic novel in particular, because it's like an eighth character to the book, just the pure visual styling of the book. So, I wonder if I can get your thoughts on that
in style, like the hard light, hard shadow, the way forms are developed, and all that kind of stuff. I think are similar to Mignola, but the composition, the energy, like all that, it's a completely different style of energy. And I feel like the characters act a lot more on the Umbrella Academy than even Hellboy. Nothing against Hellboy. I love Hellboy.
I know
you do, but the characters act a lot more, and they're more expressive. There's more what Mike does with subtle lighting and mood and those kind of things. You know, those are done in a completely different way. So
for sure.
But the way he tells a wacky story and a wacky event. Oh, the poor guy who says he won't give up his recipe for, I even forget what it was, but
it's for apple pie. He says offhand, you have to cut my arms and legs.
My arms and both my legs.
Worst thing you could ever said.
Cha-Cha has both his arms and legs off, and and they have the recipe.
As so
I, you know, I think that was I was really well told, and. Yeah. Yeah, you can't fault any of the composition. You knew exactly what was going on.
Hazel and Cha-Cha in those books are stunning.
Yeah.
And terrifying.
Yes.
Like straight up terrifying. They really, really are.
And when they bring them to the screen, you know, it doesn't really kind of make sense unless you've read the books at all.
Unless you read the book, right?
Yeah. But once you, if you've read the book, you're like, oh, all right, I'll permit it.
Exactly.
For the podcast, I think it's the first time I've gone back and forth so many times. And I felt a very rewarding experience for going back and forth between the book and the show, and really reappreciating the two, you know, art forms and the performances and the, you know, like you say, the artwork, but also the writing. I mean, the writing in the comic book, there's certain things that only a comic book writer can get away with, right? I felt like that was absolutely there on every page of you know, all three books, but especially the first one.
Yeah. Well, that's actually a perfect setup for my moment of truth, which really is all about, you know, the introduction to Apocalypse Suite. So if you guys will permit me, I'm going to read the first six pages of Apocalypse Suite. So anybody out there who hasn't read the first graphic novel, it starts off with this introduction. That's kind of like it's like the Star Wars crawl of the world of the Umbrella Academy as they introduce you into this world. And it goes something like this. It was the same year Tusslin Tom Gurney knocked out the space squid from Rigel X-9. It happened at 9:38 p.m. It came from an atomic flying elbow. And in that moment, without warning, and in an occurrence of complete coincidence, 43 extraordinary children were born to mostly single women who had shown no signs of pregnancy in seemingly random locations around the world. The children were either abandoned or put up for adoption, the ones who survived. Enter Sir Reginald Hargreaves, a.k.a. the Monocle, world-renowned scientist and wealthy entrepreneur, inventor of the Televator, the Levitator, the Mobile Umbrella Communicator, and Clever Crisp Cereal, Olympic gold medalist and recipient of the Nobel Prize for his work in the cerebral advancement of the chimpanzee, Space Alien. For reasons unknown, Sir Reginald set out with his bodyguard, Abijat, aboard his private vessel, the Minerva, rumored to be powered by the remains of King Ahmed Karaj IV. Using methods undisclosed, Using methods undisclosed, he sought to track down and adopt as many of the children as he could. He only found seven of them. Wiping their identities and concealing the children from the world, Sir Reginald held a press conference in Stockholm in which journalist Cosimo di Lestrono from Milan asked, "Why have you adopted these seven children?" To this, Hargreaves replied, "To save the world, of course." To which the world asked, "From what?" They received no answer, for it was the last time Sir Reginald and the children were seen until that day, until the day the Eiffel Tower went berserk. Okay, that is the greatest six pages of comic book storytelling I have ever read in my goddamn life. Okay, and I'm only doing it a quarter of the justice it deserves, because it's, to your point, John, it's not just the prose, right? It's the synchronicity between the prose and the imagery used to set each other off. And it's so well done. It's so nutty. It's so perfectly paced. It leaves enough room in between the prose, the imagery, to let you kind of fill in the blanks as the reader. In six very short pages, it does more world building than entire series have done with 100 issues, to be quite honest. I mean, it just sets up like this, you know, because this world is so nuts. It's there's so many details to it. You can't possibly hit them all. So they just hit these perfect details that are far enough from each other that your mind automatically connects the lines between them all and creates this bizarre map of an even more bizarre world and everything that's in it. And it's just so well done. And when I went back and reread it, I was reading the introduction and I stopped. I'm like, wait a minute, hang on, stop. I got to go back and read this again. And I went back. I was like, yeah, that was as good as I thought it was. And I had to read it again, right? And then as I kept going back, then I stopped. I was like, wait a minute. I gotta pay attention to the splash page here, right? Now, for those of you who aren't versed in comics, the splash page is the first page of the book. It's very often a single panel takes up the entirety of the page. Hence the splash page makes a splash, right? You see it and bam, it's the opening page. This splash page is one of the most remarkable things I've ever seen in graphic storytelling, right?
It takes the media res to a whole new level.
God, it does, right? It is this magnificent. So the text is, it was the same year Tussling Tom, in quotes, Tussling Tom Gurney knocked out the space squid from Rigel X9, came from an atomic flying elbow. And we have this image of Tussling Tom doing this flying atomic elbow in this like crappy mid-century wrestling ring with all these like mid-century guys looking like they're dock workers around the ring. Like they've all got their hats on. They've all got like their bedding billings, like watching this thing going on. The space alien from Rigel X9 is this like cyclopean squid-like villain who's on his back and his
filling the entire mat.
The entire mat, right? Tussling Tom is covered with spats of this alien's blood, and the alien, its eyes wide open because it looks like it doesn't have an eyelid. Its mouth is wide open. The alien does not look fearsome. It looks like, oh my God, it's an atomic flying. It's an atomic flying elbow. I'm gonna die. Exactly. And you're like, it's so good, right? And it's like, you know, like this is not the first time that we've had a wrestling match with aliens in this world, right?
These tickets cost you read. It's like I have questions. Like, what is like, going on here?
Yeah, like this is not.
Why
a
is it normal
venue?
For pro wrestling to, you know, have space right? Kids in it? Why, you know, like what is going on here?
You mean yours doesn't?
Yeah, right. There's just so much story in this one image. I just
had 43 babies and they weren't pregnant that more. Like, what does that even look like? How does that even happen?
But what's amazing about the splash page though is it Gabriel Baugh's art style. I love it, right? And to your point, you know, it's fairly simple. And I do not mean that as a slam. I mean like it's very crisp and clean. It's on one end of the spectrum, and you have somebody like, say, Jeff Darrow on the other end, right? Who's just highly intricate, packed with a million visual details, right? This is not so packed, so it's you can kind of stop and look at the discrete elements pretty easily. But like, you can flip past this page without realizing just how much story is being told there, so beautifully. It's just astonishing how well it's done. And I just saw it again. I just laughed and laughed and laughed. I was like, I can't believe they pulled this off in six pages. Like that is an amazing piece of graphic storytelling. I love telling stories myself, but this is like, you know, the more you know about how they make comics, the more you can appreciate how hard it is to make comics and how hard it is to do it well. And like, you can look at these pages and make the mistake of thinking, oh, that's simple. Like, well, okay, drawing a circle freehand is simple. That doesn't make it easy, right? Like the simplicity here betrays real mastery of narrative craft and of visual craft. And these two guys are so in sync. There are not many comics I've read where the writer and artist are so well ping-ponging back and forth off each other, right? And it's just amazing. So so my moment of truth is this opening, which it let me accept everything that comes after it with open arms, because already they've set this thing so well up. I'm just like, okay, sure.
Bill, I love that this is your moment of truth, because the great thing about the adaptation, which I think is possibly the best adaptation for screen I've seen. Like, it's up there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, really high.
I, it was excellent series of choices, right? I mean, there were so many different ways they could have gone.
Yeah, they really made a lot of really good decisions, knocked it out of the park. But every episode has its own cover page. They always have this moment, you know, like the where, you know, the stinger would normally end, where an umbrella appears on the screen, and they do it in so many clever different ways, and they're absolutely comic book splash pages. That's what they are.
So the other thing I'll say about this introduction is that now I read a frankly embarrassingly large number of graphic novels each year. I kind of go at it like a filter feeder. I just kind of get whatever I can get my hands on, and I just sort of read indiscriminately. And if it's great, it's awesome. If it's not so great, well, so well, you know, so what? And as a result, I read a lot of, you know, not great graphic novels. One of the things that really astonishes me about this introduction is that it fully communicates the nuttiness of this setting, and yet it doesn't lose narrative focus. And there's actually a sense of restraint to it. It doesn't look like it, but there is. And I have never seen a book that started off in fifth gear the way this does, and not completely just go flying off the road by the end of the first issue, beginning of the second issue. Usually at that point, it's just because it's so drunk on its own gonzo storytelling, it forgets that there are invisible rules you have to play by. And this book never forgets those rules. And it's amazing how it just keeps dipping into this well of nuttiness, and it never overplays its hand. And it,
I think they never forgot what the story was about, which was the dysfunction of the family.
The fact that you mention how in sync these two guys are is crazy when you consider, like, you know, go reread the introduction and, you know, where they talk about how this was put together. And it's amazing how they stayed in sync, because Gerard Way is on tour with the band. He's sending pages of story off, and then, you know, like, it's back and forth. It's not like they're even sitting in the same room together most of the time. So, you know, that as a feat in and of itself is just astonishing to me. I mean, I don't know too much about the creative process of you know, writing comic books or anything like that, but you know what, like, that to me is amazing. Especially when you have the distraction of like a world tour, and you're still wanting to see this story told in such a compelling fashion that you're putting that extra effort in order to make that happen. That to me is just bonkers, off the wall. Like, I don't even know how it happened.
And it wasn't just that they managed to do it. They shipped this book on time. Right. Actually, people were like, okay,
Liefeld.
They're like, you know, Way is never going to make his deadlines. And apparently it got really close a bunch of times, but like, he was always like kind of building the track, and the train of art was kind of chasing him, but he pulled it off. That is so important. Like, so many comics these days just do not abide by their deadlines, and can be like years overdue.
Which is why we have people like Liefeld, who honestly he made a career on being timely.
and you got timely
and enthusiastic.
And they've got guys like Joe Madureira, who's just fantastic at what he does, but the guy could just get into a situation where he just couldn't deliver, right? And couldn't make something done on time. So the timeliness thing works. The only other collaboration that I've ever seen kind of like this is, have you guys ever read the book 100 Bullets by...
No.
Your recommendation, by the way.
But Brian Azzarello and Itaro Arderiso. First of all, everybody read 100 Bullets. That is one of my favorite comics of all time. 100 Bullets is such a great crime war story. Azzarello was in like Chicago, and his artist was in like Argentina, right? And I don't think they met for like, probably they did like a couple dozen issues before they actually connected with each other physically, saw each other in the real world. And I thought that was like, well, that's superhuman timing. Like, these guys managed to make it happen. That can't be topped. And then I read Umbrella Academy. I'm like, dude's writing on tour. Like it takes a lot of energy out of you to write. Okay. It does, let alone doing it after a concert or whenever the hell he was doing it. Like, it's just astonishing he did it at all. It really is. There are more than two people living within Gerard Way is all I can say. Right. And it's a little unfair, and I'm just going to say it at that, but these comics have been such a joy to read. And I really, really love the heck out of them. I can't wait for the Sparrow Academy to come out. I will snap that up very eagerly when it comes around. That'll be like, my money will blister my fingers.
Wait. So the show is like ahead of the comic talk.
I think the show is like a la
Game of Thrones.
Because at the end of Hotel Oblivion, which is the third volume, it ends with them meeting the Sparrow Academy. Like, oh, hey, who are you guys, right? But it does not get into all the stuff they get into in season three. So the show is now well ahead of the comic book.
That's nuts.
Yeah. So
I don't know what to do with that.
you know what though? For a property like Umbrella Academy, there should be a weird sense of non-linearity.
I suppose.
Right? It should be hard. It should be hard to follow. It's like
time travel right off the bat. You know, it's
bada bing, bada boom.
Well, with that in mind, Chris, let's go over to you and what your moment of truth is. Walk us through what it is, where it comes from, talk us up to it, and then kind of give us a sense of, you know, why this moment kind of is your lens through which you really kind of see the rest of the story.
As I approached this, you know, I saw it first in the show. I watched the first two seasons and absolutely loved them. Thanks to my friends, had access to the graphic novels, which I adored, read them all. I think the world of the universe, what you were talking about, Bill, that sort of assumed universe storytelling, it's something that I love. It's why I love Tolkien, and it's why I love Venture Brothers, which we're going to get to eventually.
So good. Venture Brothers is so good.
I love them for the same
reasons. Spoiler alert. Yeah.
You know, as I went through, I had all this familiarity, you know, it felt like the X-Men or the New Mutants to me. Doom Patrol, yeah, sure. These characters are more alive than the X-Men to me. And I think that's because in a ongoing comic universe, your DC or your Marvel, every character has done everything at this point. You know, everybody's turned bad or turned good and turned back again. Everybody's died and come back to life. And like, I feel like so many characters share so many story arcs, and these guys are just, they're presented to me in a really pure and vivid way, both in the show and on the page. The moment that really broke my heart was the reveal of the rumor, Allison's sin. You know, she's lost her child. You know, this is a condition during the show and during the books that is not explained for a while. And eventually it's revealed that what she did was something that every parent in the world has done. She told her daughter, just be good. You know, just go to sleep. It's bedtime. And the only reason it's a sin is that her words are more powerful than ours.
Yeah.
And it's heartbreaking to me. Like, it's absolutely unforgivable what she does to her daughter. But it's so human, so understandable. And there's just not a lot of narratives that have ever given me that kind of combination of something that I can imagine doing myself, and yet it's a absolutely unforgivable, indefensible sin.
Yeah.
These characters' powers are their tragic flaws.
Yeah.
And
sure.
And that's why their stories are all tragedies. Allison is probably the least traumatized of any of them. In that, you know, she picked up on how her power worked quickly and was able to please Hargreaves. I don't think that Allison ever faced a lot of correction.
No.
You know, Luther was enthralled to Hargreaves, right? Like, yeah. You know, all he ever wanted to do was please him. And the revelation that he couldn't please him is his trauma. His trauma is late breaking. I mean, you know, if we ignore all the trauma of a child his age seeing all the violence that he saw.
Yeah, and having his head grafted onto the body of a Martian gorilla. Apart from that little peccadillo.
But that wasn't enough trauma.
Yeah. It's a detail.
But, you know, they're deeply, deeply human characters, all of them products of trauma inflicted on them by Hargreaves, as well as whatever cosmic accident gave them their powers. And he just makes everything worse.
Yeah. Oh, God, he does. Yeah.
Everything he touches, it turns to absolute garbage. And yet, in season two, just a suggestion to number five, Try seconds. Not decades. It makes a difference. Like, yeah. Hart Reeves is someone who is seeing clearly. He doesn't love his children.
Yeah.
But he's got vision. I love all these kids and I want to hate him. And yet he's also, though he's not human, kind of human.
Yeah.
I love this story. I love it.
When we had our X-Men episode a couple of seasons ago, and we stopped from to talk about, you know, Professor X, right? And like, is, you know, how good of a guy is he really, right? And he's like, well, I have my powers, but I don't use them to affect people's minds because it's a violation. But like, yeah, he kind of does. Right? It's convenient. We kind of talked about like, okay, but like, you know, how good is he really? It's been kind of an open question with the X-Men over the years. With Hargreaves, we explore this full through. Like, here's what it looks like. Like, Professor X is a saint compared to Reginald Hargreaves. Right? I mean, X is like father of the century compared to Hargreaves. Hargreaves is horrible.
I mean, well, deeply. Know, it's funny too that, you know, you have number five, who is probably the wisest of all of them, gives you like
the oldest.
He's the only, he spent all this time alone, but he's like, he tells you right off the bat, like, I should have listened to the old man, you know, and you get
right.
a sort of playback yeah. of the yeah. scene where he tells him, you know, no, this is not a simple thing, skipping through time.
Yeah.
And sure enough, you know, the guy ends up trapped, you know, for 16, you know, or, you know, what, it was 40 something years, I think, right?
And the apocalypse that they're trying to prevent is the one that they created.
Yeah.
It's the one that Five created.
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Right. Yeah. Yeah. They're carrying the apocalypse.
Can't fault the guy for like not having vision because he does
right.
have vision.
Yeah. He's completely right about Vanya.
He's got no, yeah. you know, no patience to explain any of this to his children. He's got no love for them. Throw something out and just be completely right about it, which is one of the most frustrating things. Like yeah. this guy
it's
that
so
you
real.
Hate,
it's
like,
so real
right most of the time.
Exactly. God, can you just be wrong more, please?
Chris, there was just one thing I wanted to say more about Allison. You know, first of all, I love that you picked her moment, her choice, and her motivation to. I've never seen a motivation that made more sense for a parent not to seek out their child. She knew what she had done was she couldn't forgive herself, and right, she knew right. how bad that was. That was the real painful part was, I mean, she could have done anything she wanted to get back to her daughter.
Right.
But she knew that what she had done was so unforgivable and so scary, but you know what that means to her.
Yeah.
Yeah. I it's heartbreaking to me. Like it's just like it's presented to me in a hologram, this, you know, this axis of pain and self-recrimination. I feel it so strongly when I dip into this universe.
But I mean, most stories about parents that are separated from their children, well, there's never a motivation that makes sense for the parent not to come back to their child, right? There's the hero's always trying to get back to their child, even if they did something terrible or something terrible happened. The ultimate basis of the story is that they loved their kids.
Right.
Yeah.
She did something that was selfish.
This is probably my favorite part of the whole, like, season one is that reveal, that aspect of her character. Yeah. It hit me a lot harder in the show than it did in the comic. In part because I think part of it is just a matter of like how it's acted, you know, in the show and how they gave certain aspects more room to breathe in the show to kind of flesh it out a little bit more. But in the comic, it's like they get into, she didn't just do that. She told her husband that he loved her. And then she goes and she does the exact same thing. She puts the whammy on Luther and is like, I heard you wanted to kiss me since you're 8 years old. Right. And so she's done it a couple of times. In the comic, The Umbrella Academy, like the 8-page intro that they did on a free comic book day, which I think got folded into the back of Apocalypse Suite as like an add-on story. That's actually like the very first Umbrella Academy story ever told, right? And it starts off with the Rumor's dead on the ground, and the Rumor is also staying there alive. Like, geez, Rumor, you're dead. Sorry about that. And they're trying to figure out, okay, who killed the Rumor, and why is there a second Rumor here? In the show, it seems more like her power is more like Jedi mind control, right? Whereas in the comic, it's like, no, her power actually alters reality. She's nearly omnipotent. Right. Yeah. It's really kind of limited by her imagination. But she's a little bit more free with it and in that intro story, she was basically like skipping out on class or whatever, and like kind of doing this thing. Like, she was basically doing like a truancy sort of deal and using her voice to kind of get around it. And that's what created this little hiccup in reality that got, let the bad guys kill a duplicate of her while she was out like clubbing or whatever. Right. We get the sense that there is a dishonesty to her. Like, her power isn't just lying. It's like, she is a liar. She, you know, and so, yeah. But in the book,
they call her Rumor.
In the book, yes, she's a manipulative liar, but when you compare that against all the other mayhem and monstrosity going on around them, her transgressions are small potatoes, right? Yeah. Right? They really, really are. Yeah. And so you kind of, you're like, that's bad, but you can easily forgive it. In the show, you really can't. In the show, they really give it that humanity. I felt myself engaging in the show as a parent in a way that I didn't with the graphic novel. And that's not a slam on the graphic novel. It's just they told the story in different ways. Yeah. And so I love that you mentioned this, because in the show, yeah, it just, it you're like, don't, you can see like, don't, oh, Allison, don't do it. Don't do it. And she does it. You're like, oh God, no. It's heartbreaking, right? It's heartbreaking.
It's awful. Awful. And I love it.
It's great storytelling.
Human.
Yeah.
What more human thing to do?
That's it. You can picture, you know, potentially yourself doing that. Like,
absolutely.
I would, as a parent, if I had that kind of power, oh my God.
You know what? Every parent has had a day they wish they could take back, right? Every parent did. They had a call, they had a moment. They were just on the edge and they reacted to their kids in a way they wish they could take back. This is that fear times 1 billion. Like, yes, she was wrong. No, I can't really blame her, you know?
Because that's that me. Moment, that's can, me.
Right. In yeah. that moment,
yeah, you know,
can empathize and.
Yeah, you know, she just happened to have a power that made it for forever. Yeah. And it's, I guess, like, their powers are their flaws, as you said. Chris, my question is there another character that kind of lands as well or goes as deep as Allison does for you in this scene, would you say?
Oh, Klaus. Well, Klaus is stunning in the show. It's so empathetic. And, you know, especially from the moment you see him locked in that crypt, right? Like, you see what he's gone through, and so you understand his substance abuse, and of course he's a substance abuser. I mean, everything about him is so understandable given what Hargreaves put him through, and I love that, you know, his like end game in Dallas is he started a cult. Like, when he's abandoned to his own devices, he starts a cult because it gives him the support he needs and lets him be himself, you know?
Yeah.
He creates a safe space for himself, and I think that's pretty cool.
In case there's any followers out there,
right?
Any potential followers.
Yeah. Wait,
I like the way you looked into the camera on that. For anyone that's listening to the podcast, Chris looked directly at you.
he is someone who, I mean, life gave him some lemons, and he's just squeezing whatever pleasure he can out of it, and I so understand him. Oh,
you know, Chris, you're making an awful lot of sense to me. I think I'd like to read the pamphlet.
This is a great message, Chris. How much money do you need to spend to share it?
I don't know, but. I've got some herbal products I'd like to share with you.
Fantastic.
It's called, not MLM.
Tomato, tomato. So anyway, you know, one last thing I'll say about the characters is that, and this is something I never quite thought of again until I reread the books. But I think this applies to the show and to the books kind of equally, which is that when I first encountered the story, I felt really bad for Ben, for the horror, because he was the one who dies as a kid off stage. You know, he's the fallen member. And the more
Important to the show. So important.
More important to the show than to the book, ultimately, at least as far as we have now. But the more I get to know the Umbrella Academy, the more I realize Ben's such an important character because he's the one who gets off easy by dying. Right? Yes. Like, he actually has the best fate of them all because he died quickly. He has least trauma because he's a corpse, right?
He's unspoiled, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the kind of context that draws everybody else, like, so, like, his statue gets cut in half by Luther and Diego when they're fighting, and like it's just, but he's the lucky one. Like, that's how messed up these characters are, right? He's the lucky one. Like, man.
He tells you, too, like, you know, like, in there's a scene, you know, in season one where he's, you know, talking to Klaus about how badly it sucks to be tethered to him now that he's dead. Yeah. But you're still like, yeah, you're getting off easy, man. Yeah.
even adjusting for that. Yeah, exactly. So before we go, I'd like to hit us with the final thought here. Season two of the Umbrella Academy premiered on July 31st, 2020. It instantly became Netflix's most watched show, and in its first 28 days, it brought in over 43 million viewers worldwide. The season scored a 91% rating on Rotten Tomatoes and was just a certified blockbuster out of the gate, and a third season was locked in. However, there would be a complication that the showrunners did not anticipate. On December 1st, Elliot Page, who plays Vanya Hargreaves, announced in a heartfelt public statement that he is transgender. He wrote, quote, "Hi, friends. I want to share with you that I am trans. My pronouns are he, they, and my name is Elliot," Page wrote. Quote, "I love that I am trans, and I love that I am queer. And the more I hold myself close and fully embrace who I am, the more I dream, the more my heart grows, and the more I thrive. To all the trans people who deal with harassment, self-loathing, abuse, and the threat of violence every day, I see you. I love you, and I will do everything I can to change this world for the better," end quote. Within a week of that, Netflix updated Page's on-screen credits to reflect his name change for seasons one and two of The Umbrella Academy, as well as on Page's other movie and series credits within Netflix's streaming library. But a more delicate issue remained. Season three of The Umbrella Academy had already been written. So with Page's transition, what would become of Vanya, and more importantly, of Page's portrayal of her? Series creator Steve Blackman worked closely with Page to revise and rewrite the season to work in Vanya's own transition into Victor Hargreaves. Transgender writer and journalist Thomas Page McBee was brought on to ensure that Victor's transition story was told with the dignity and respect that it deserved. The result was an unexpected storyline that many critics felt was the emotional highlight, not just of the season, but of the series. Not every show would have handled one of its stars' transition the way that The Umbrella Academy did, but The Umbrella Academy made room for one of its own to present their authentic self and to create the kind of psychological safety that let Page deliver what might just be the performance of his lifetime thus far. It took a special kind of sensitivity, acceptance, and support from a very large number of people to make that happen. When they say that not all heroes wear capes, this is the kind of thing they're talking about. It's also the kind of thing that Sir Reginald Hargreaves would never have understood. And it's the kind of thing that underscores the deepest theme of this show and of the comic from which it's adapted, that families might be made by circumstance, but they are strengthened and sustained by consistent and deliberate acts of love. Even in a world full of time-traveling assassins, talking goldfish, and extra-dimensional prisons, love is still the greatest superpower there is, always has been, and it always will be. This has been Moments of Truth. On behalf of myself, Tom, Chris, and John, thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time. Moments of Truth is hosted by Bill Coffin, Chris Crenshaw, Tom Hespos, and Joe Pace. This podcast is edited by Derek Eisenhart. The Moments of Truth theme is a mashup of The Claremont by Flash Fluherty and a little help from a Texas Instruments Speak and Spell. For more Moments of Truth, be sure to subscribe to this show wherever you get your favorite podcasts, or check us out on YouTube or at momentsoftruth.show. And now, a little crass commercialism. Thanks for listening.
3, 2, 1. Dollars.
When Andy Chester loses his young wife Lisa to breast cancer, he finds himself on a grief journey with no certain destination. As he confronts his greatest fears about death, Andy must reckon with the possibility that there may be no life after Lisa. Read After Lisa, the new novel by best-selling author Joe Pace, available now on Amazon and wherever fine books are sold.
Susie Faulkner has fought against the darkness her whole life, but will her skills be enough against her evil equal? Never Back Down, number 3 in the Faulkner Family Thriller Series by Christopher Swan, available now.
Experience 53 of the greatest weird fiction short stories ever published by Mary Shelley, H.P. Lovecraft, Gray Lespina, Ambrose Bierce, and many more in Tales from the Outer Canon, a new weird fiction anthology edited by Bill Coffin. Get Tales from the Outer Canon today on Amazon or for free on archive.org. The Yellow Kingdom.